Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. When today's guest, journalist Clay Risen, began doing research for his new book about the Red Scare 6 years ago, he had no idea that Donald Trump would be back in office. But here we are. Law firms are quietly scrubbing DEI references from their websites to appease Trump, according to The Guardian. On Wednesday, the Trump administration said it will screen social media accounts of immigrants and visa applicants for what it calls anti-Semitic activity. The Education Department has launched an End DEI portal where students and parents can report on teachers for DEI lessons taught in their classrooms. Clay Risen provides much-needed historical context for these anti-DEI, anti-intellectual, and watch-what-you-say policies in his new book, Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. He examines how Senator Joseph McCarthy and a vast network of government officials and organizations led a ruthless campaign that destroyed thousands of lives in a paranoid crusade against alleged communist conspiracies. Clay Risen says it's impossible to understand today's new right without a proper understanding of the Red Scare. Clay Risen is an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times and a member of the Society of American Historians. He's the author of many works of American history. His latest is Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Hi, Clay. Thank you so much for this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it is wild to think that when you started writing this book, you had no idea that Trump was going to win another term and usher in what we're seeing right now. So how did you decide to explore this dark era about 6 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, look, 6 years ago, it felt there was kind of a vibe, I would say, that I felt made the book feel relevant. But that's different from what we're seeing today, which is these incredibly just on the nose parallels. Kind of wake up every morning and see a news story that reflects something pretty directly in my book. But I was really interested in it more as a history question. I've written several books on post-war American history, and it just seemed like the Red Scare was this moment that is poorly understood and yet had such an important impact on that post-war history. So it was something I wanted to really address front and center.
What about some of the connections? There's a striking paragraph in your book. You write, there is a lineage to the American hard right of today. And to understand it, we need to understand its roots in the Red Scare. It did not originate then, nor is Trumpism and the MAGA movement the same as McCarthyism and the John Birch Society. But there is a line linking them. I merely want to suggest and demonstrate that it had a particular moment in the late 40s and in a certain political and cultural context, and that knowing where we are today requires understanding where we were then. Can you elaborate on this? Because, you know, another reason, Clay, why your book is so important is because Trump and so many of his supporters are trying to rewrite this country's history.
Yeah, you know, a lot of my interest in American history is in this sort of soft tissue legacy of events. So when you look at something and you think, this happened from this point in time to this point in time, there's a beginning, there's an end. I'm interested in sort of what came after that and what was the impact that, even as people moved on, still resonated in maybe in dark corners. So I think the Red Scare is a great example of that. We can trace its rise and fall. We can look at McCarthy being the dominant figure in American politics and then falling off by 1954. We can see the country kind of getting back to its, I guess, quote unquote, normal self. But look, when McCarthy fell, there were 30% of Americans still thought he did the right thing. And when he died in 1957, that same percentage thought that he was a martyr and that he had been taken down by the evil forces within the U.S. government. People didn't say the deep state back then, but this idea that there was some anti-American liberal elite radical, what have you, group at the heart of American society, American government that needed to be rooted out with aggression. You know, that was the driving force behind the Red Scare, and it's something that I think has really stuck with us over the years. And it's not always obvious, it's not always near the mainstream, but you look at the Goldwater movement or the Buchananite movement in the early 90s, and I think again today, and you can draw that line, whether it's sort of ideas or specific people, areas of influence. I think there's a direct lineage.
You say that when this ended, 30% of the public still supported it. And 30% of the public voted for Trump. A lot of people say half the country voted for Trump, but it's always important to remember that almost half the country does not vote. And so when you really look at the numbers, it is about 30 or so percent who voted for him. So it's very similar to what happened back then.
Yeah, it is. And obviously we're talking about many, many decades. These are different people, different alignments. But I think in the end, the story that attracts a depressingly, shockingly large number of people is this simplified version of what is, honestly, a very complex society that we live in, and a very diverse society, a society that changes very dynamically, and often, unfortunately, creates winners and losers. And I don't mean to dismiss people's opinions and people's individual stories, but in that complexity, it can become very easy to say, oh, the problem is that there is this cabal of elites at the heart of our government who are opposed to me. And of course, the me is always American, right? Whoever it is, they think of themselves as the American ideal. And so, this syllogism sort of becomes self-evident and self-actualizing. If that is the case, that there is this cabal, this deep state, then all bets are off in terms of what has to be done, and all the more willing people are to align with demagogues who come along and say, I can fix it. I alone can fix it. And we saw that with any number of people through the subsequent decades.
There are so many books out there about the Red Scare. In fact, a lot of books with the Red Scare in their title. What did you want to do differently? Why did you feel that it was time to write another book about the Red Scare?
Yeah, so it's been a while since there's been a book about the Red Scare, and a lot of the books, and there's some very good ones, but a lot of them were concerned with I'd say hashing out ideological battles of the time, right? Most of them were written during the Cold War, and most of them took a very stridently liberal left-wing position. And I think that, at the end of the day, I think the Red Scare was a terrible event, but there's also been a lot of evidence to emerge since then that shows, for example, that certain people, Alger Hiss and the Rosenbergs, were guilty, that the Soviet Union did have influence through the American Communist Party here in the United States, and that, there were concerns about justified concerns about security. So I wanted to kind of maybe start from a slightly different premise in terms of the facts, and then try to assess, does that therefore change the story of the Red Scare? To me, it doesn't really. And then the other thing I wanted to do was simply tell a story that was relevant for today, without being presentist, but to write a book that in 2025 spoke to the historical interests of readers today. That's, I think, the need of every historian is not just to tell new stories, but to tell older stories or known stories in ways that make sense to their readers at the time.
Well, let's dig into the history and talk about what really struck you, given that you are a historian. The Red Scare ushered in a wave of hysteria about the supposed threat of communism in the U.S. during the Cold War, and it really peaked in the early 50s. You write, to be labeled a communist was a social and career death sentence. Old friends stopped returning calls. Farmers and business owners accused of communist ties found themselves unable to get bank loans. Threatening phone calls would come late at night, and letters promising horrific violence in the afternoon mail. Tires were slashed, windows were smashed. Newspapers regularly reported vigilante mobs assaulting left-wing journalists, labor leaders, and activists. Talk about how this all began.
Yeah, and you put your finger on something that I also wanted to do with the book was, you know, while telling kind of the greatest hits, right, the Rosenbergs, Alger Hiss, the Hollywood 10, you know, these sort of more popular or more well-known stories, I also wanted to show the depth of the Red Scare and just how much it suffused American society in everyday life. Down to the teachers and postal workers and local union leaders. But, you know, a lot of this comes out of sort of another thing that I wanted to do with the book was to show the cultural aspect of it. You know, I believe, and I argue in the book, that one of the root causes of the Red Scare was that there had been this long simmering cultural conflict over the emergence of the New Deal. And not just the policies of the New Deal, but the whole culture of the New Deal, the idea that American society would move toward a more progressive, more cosmopolitan, more pluralistic and tolerant America, more secular, would promote women's rights and rights of people of color, civil rights, labor rights, and so on. That was a powerful urge in the 30s, but it wasn't uncontested. There are a lot of people who did not want that. And it was only with the emergence of the Cold War after World War II and this sort of overwhelming sense of fear that came with the Cold War that suddenly the conservatives, these revanchists who wanted to push back against that New Deal culture, suddenly had a weapon. You know, they could say, look, all of those people have been tainted by communism, or they have ideas about communism that are no longer safe in America. We need to get rid of them. And there was this idea after World War II, in some ways drawing on World War II, of just the need for absolute security. Like, we can't take risks in America if we are on the brink of World War III. If there is somebody who can be even in the most minute way suspected of disloyalty or radical ideas, they need to be pushed aside. And that became the guiding logic for years, both at the top level, you know, so that, you know, purging the State Department and other federal agencies, you know, down to the most local level, going after teachers, going after postal workers, government clerks, making everyone sign loyalty oaths. And it became just a part of American life. And in a way that, I mean, not to bring it back to the present all the time, but does feel like today, in that you have to go through your life. You have to go through your everyday life. And we all have jobs and we all do our thing, but we all know that these terrible things are happening. And how do you deal with both of those at the same time? Mm. The Red Scare was one of those moments.
You know, as a historian, do you think that most people really know what the New Deal was? Do people know about the New Deal history?
Well, it's funny. You know, I grew up in Tennessee, and I was always very aware of the impact that the New Deal had on my region. The creation of the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. There were no lakes in Tennessee before the TVA came along. Literally hundreds of lakes were built by the TVA for dams to provide electricity. Hundreds of miles of highways, rural electrification, Works Progress Administration buildings, you know, the art of the New Deal was very present. And I was aware of this, a history-minded kid, but I don't think a lot of people were. I think it was just, in some ways, the New Deal was so successful and so much a part, restitched American life in such a thorough way that it wasn't something that was ever really thought of as this moment. It was almost like that's how things always had been. But I know talking to my grandparents and hearing the stories of their grandparents that life had been very different before that, and especially in the rural South. But no, I think you're right that one of the things that historians always have to deal with, particularly historians of more recent American history, is the amnesia that sets in. I think it's self-evident that people would know about what happened in the 30s and 40s or the 70s, but that's not the case.
And it's just so important to remember this time. As you wrote, when you look back at the New Deal, it just catalyzed so much social change, opening the doors to women and African Americans, industrial unions, newly protected by the Labor Relations Board, catalyzed an entire culture around the American worker. Gay men and lesbians were finding occasional refuge and opportunity to be themselves. The old order was breaking down. And I think this is such an important point, and this is what really scared the capitalist class. Taking together, the 1930s left was a near seamless spectrum, running from center-of-the-road liberals to hardcore communists, agreeing to disagree on the details, but united on the big things like racial equality, labor rights, fighting fascism, and also defending the New Deal. And when you think about center-of-the-road liberals with hardcore communists coming together on these issues, I mean, that's a lot of people that poses a major threat to the capitalist class.
Yeah, absolutely. And and it's the capitalist class, but it's also cultural conservatives. It's, I mean, it's in some ways it's the that coalition on the right that it remains pretty stable today, linking cultural conservatives, religious conservatives, white conservatives with the money class, because they in this way have a shared interest, even though in a lot of other ways they don't. But I think this is another way that this era really set the tone and maybe the chessboard for all of our politics and our cultural conflicts going forward. Is this sort of alignment between a specific type of left and a specific type of right? And it's but and I think what's somewhat tragic is that there was this, as you mentioned, there was this moment in the 30s when there was a broad coalition on the left that was empowered, that was in government, not only the White House, but also controlled Congress and in many states, and was doing immense things in terms of lifting up the impoverished, empowering labor unions, literally building modern America through dams and post offices and all sorts of structures. And the Red Scare splintered that. It drove a wedge between centrist and the left-wing labor unions, between social movements. I mean, it set back the civil rights movement by decades. And still, resonated even after the Red Scare ended, the division between more, let's say, radical elements and more centrist elements. I even hesitate to use the word radical because, in our eyes, that's such a loaded term because of this. What we consider radical in the United States is not really radical in a lot of other places. But we use that term because it's so much a part of our political discourse, and I'm guilty of that. But we're still stuck with that. We're still stuck with this wariness between the center left and the I guess progressive left that doesn't really exist on the right.
Right, because you say that the left went after each other as a result, and you saw this most pointedly in the union movement, where the AFL-CIO, before they merged, the CIO purged all the leftists and the communists and the sympathizers. But then when you look on the right, as you've said in a couple past interviews, conservatives figure this out more cleanly. They do not waste their energy fighting each other.
Yeah, I mean, you can point to all kinds of superficial fights. I mean, right now, you have fiscal conservatives fighting with Mike Johnson over the budget plan, but that's superficial. At the end of the day, those guys have a pretty clear idea about what the main project is. And too many times on the left, you haven't seen that. And you've seen real fights, and in some ways, unavoidable fights. I don't mean that this is necessarily a hit at them. I think it's there's something tragic. I'm not sure that the movement, the labor movement, could have avoided the civil war that broke out in the late 40s. But the consequence is indisputable. The CIO kicked out a million members and essentially ruled them, you know, persona non grata in the labor movement, and that hamstrung the movement, especially as the corporate America started to regain its feet, started to push back pretty significantly on labor gains. It was hard for the movement to present a unified front. And you can look at that in all kinds of aspects of left-wing politics. And it's just not something that we as a country have ever really been able to get past. And I think it has a pretty distorting effect on policy and political outcomes.
It's so important to talk about how these different factions, while they maybe had major disagreements on social issues, were able to still come together. So you have people who, you know, care mostly about, let's say, money and deregulation, and then you've got people who are anti-abortion or, you know, very religious, for example, back then. You see the same thing today under Trump. I mean, he's really done an incredible job of bringing these different factions together. And then there's the racism. And in your book, you write, as many Americans came together around Roosevelt and the New Deal, a backlash was brewing. Some of the complaints were about policy. Employers resented Roosevelt's pro-labor stance, as well as his fighting words attacking, quote, economic royalists. Farmers appreciated government support, but hated being told what to do and when to plant. Southern politicians loved the outpouring of federal aid, like electrification, parks, roads, but detested the possibility that those funds might benefit their Black neighbors. So can you talk a little bit about that, what you uncovered around how it's okay for me, but it's not okay for my Black neighbor, and then bring that also, connect that to what we're seeing today?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really held the New Deal back was that, you know, Roosevelt was able to start with a pretty coherent, cohesive Democratic coalition, linking urban Democrats and Black Democrats in the North with Southern Democrats, you know, pro-segregation, Jim Crow, racist Southern Democrats, who were open to populist appeals. That began to splinter pretty quickly when it became clear that Roosevelt wanted to extend the benefits of the New Deal to Black Americans. Especially in the South, where you had sharecroppers who needed federal intervention to help them not get bankrupted by white landowners. And the Southern Democrats pretty systematically pared all of that back and said, you know, if you want our support, you're going to have to make sure this doesn't go to benefit Blacks. And that was pretty effective. But there was also a radicalized opposition. And often these things overlapped, where while some Southern Democrats might have been fine, collaborating or working with Roosevelt on those terms, a lot of them leaned into this talk of the New Deal as socialist or Marxist or communist. And it was part of a way of attacking liberalism and these liberal ideas that they said were coming from the outside, that were, you know, not endemic to the South. So any civil rights worker was necessarily an outsider bringing outsider ideas. And, you know, so this sort of all became kind of a mush of talking points, but also persuasive ones, right? So pretty quickly, what it meant to be a communist, what it meant to be a Marxist or what have you, became disconnected with any actual meaning. No one was reading Marx or actually proposing communism. And, you know, how that connects today, I mean, obviously you see someone like President Trump using these words with abandon. He can't seem to say Democrat without saying radical Democrat or Marxist Democrat. Could he explain how Nancy Pelosi is a Marxist. I don't think anybody could explain that. But it's just sort of part of the toolbox now to say anyone to the left that I disagree with is not just someone I disagree with, but is fundamentally anti-American and has to be in some way purged from our society. And that's obviously incredibly dangerous when we start to talk about, well, what does that actually mean? You know, it means excluding types of political discourse. It also means violating civil liberties. It also means suppressing people's speech.
We're going to take a quick break. On today's Your Call, we're spending the hour with Clay Risen, an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times. We're talking about his latest book, Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Clay Risen, an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times and a member of the Society of American Historians. Clay Risen is the author of many works of American history. His latest, Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. If you have any questions for Clay, he provides much-needed historical context for the anti-DEI and Watch What You Say policies that we are seeing right now. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Art who says, what lessons have we learned from the Red Scare that we can apply to the current situation in the U.S.? What steps can we take now to save democracy and free speech? What are your thoughts, Clay?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think, you know, the first thing I'd say is unfortunately a mistake that's being made already, and that is that the legal community is not standing up the way it needs to. One of the things that happened during the Red Scare that made the Red Scare possible was that law firms, judges, the civil liberties community, by and large, shrank from their responsibilities. There were a few firms, there were a few lawyers who individually stood up to great risk for their own careers. But by and large, the ACLU did not drape itself in glory. But I think I think a lot of groups and sectors there learned their lesson, and the ACLU later became, quite stalwart, as it should be. Today, I think that lesson has been lost to some extent. You just look at the number of law firms that are going along with and, in a lot of ways facilitating civil liberties violations. But I think there are a lot of people who are standing up and who are willing to put their careers and their livelihoods on the line to defend people who are, being deported or being shut out because of their political beliefs. And so I think that just going forward, more people need to take that to heart. I think, another thing is just that, I mean, I hate to say that all things end, but, the Red Scare did end, and it left a different America than we had. People need to keep that in sight as well. And that if Americans stand up for what they believe in and what America means, then we can at least preserve that through to the end, to a period when civil liberties go back to mean what they should mean.
Well, to your point, the CNBC has a piece today. This is actually getting a lot of coverage. Trump said today that five more law firms have struck agreements with his administration that involve them committing to at least $600 million in pro bono work for the causes he supports. He actually went on Truth Social. He says today, Trump and Kirkland and Ellis, Allen, Sterling, Simpson, Thatcher, there's a lot of names there, announced the following agreement regarding a series of actions to be taken by these law firms.
I mean, one law firm that stood out during the Red Scare and stands out today is Arnold and Porter. I think they deserve a lot of credit. They took on nearly 200 pro bono cases during the Red Scare, defending people who were, in one way or the other, falsely or unfairly accused of disloyalty. And they obviously survived. Today, Arnold and Porter is a giant law firm, but Arnold and Porter has also continued that tradition. Even though they're a big corporate firm, they have continued to stand, I think, on the right side of things. And I just wish more firms followed that model.
Well, thank you for the email, Art. If you'd like to join today's conversation with Clay Risen about his new book, Red Scare, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. Let's talk about another Red Scare weapon, the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was created in 1938 to go after extremists. Tell us about the history of that committee.
Yeah, it's sort of ironic because it was created by a left-leaning congressman to go after fascists and pro-German sentiment in the United States. But very quickly, it was captured by an anti-Roosevelt, anti-New Deal Republican or Democrat from Texas named Martin Dies, who used it to, go on what was seen as sort of a quixotic, quackish sort of hunt for communists in the federal government. He insisted that the federal government, including the White House, was riven with Soviet and pro-Soviet operatives. And he was successful. He in some ways, but he was mostly seen as a quack and a fringe guy. But then after the war, in that same way that I described, as suddenly everything became about security and about loyalty. It got a lifeline, and suddenly HUAC, as it was known, became one of the central battlegrounds, I'd say, or weapons, as you said, in this hunt for communists. And HUAC went after nonprofits. It went after. I talk about one group that was a helped refugees from the Spanish Civil War. They were targeted, and their board all went to jail for contempt when they wouldn't participate. HUAC went after Hollywood in two series of hearings. These are the famous Hollywood 10 hearings that led to the blacklist. But HUAC went after all sorts. I mean, they had constant hearings Whether it was in schools or it was in colleges or postal workers or you name it, they had a hearing on it. And often those hearings had dramatic consequences for the people who were called forward and for people who were in and around them, who acted field hearings. So they would go to Seattle or Indianapolis and really dig into the local community and catalyze a sort of local Red Scare, right? So people who thought maybe they could avoid the Red Scare nationally would suddenly find HUAC coming to town, and everything was suddenly at risk for them. So it was part of the backbone of the Red Scare.
You actually begin your prologue by sharing the story of Helen Reed Bryan, who appeared before HUAC January 24th, 1946, as executive secretary of a small New York-based charity called the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. They raised funds, as you said, for the surviving victims of the Spanish Civil War. Why did you decide to start with the story of 51-year-old Helen Reed Bryan?
Well, in some ways, she is exactly the kind of person that I wanted to focus on in the book, right? First of all, she's not famous. She had an important job, but she was not famous. She was not a communist, but in the 1930s, she worked in a range of progressive organizations. She was very adamant and very active in civil rights and women's rights, in anti-war movements. And, so she is an archetype for this type of person who was lauded in the 30s, and then suddenly under the Red Scare came in for persecution. And I also chose her because she was incredibly brave. She was the first person to go to jail the first person to go to jail for contempt of Congress ever. And she was the first person, I think, you'd say the first victim of the Red Scare. She refused to hand over her organization's papers, their files, and tried to give a statement that stood up to them. They wouldn't let her, and she found herself in prison. And really, her life was ruined because after she got out, the FBI continued to hound her. She couldn't find a job. She ended up going into seclusion in Vermont. But still, I like to imagine that she still had, she knew what she did was right, and that she didn't regret what she did. And for me, that's both in that way, different from the way that a lot of people acted during the Red Scare, but also very heartening at its core that someone like her could stand up and could find the courage to say no.
How many people's lives were affected and really ruined by all of this?
You know, it's I hate to avoid the question because it's a very important one. It's hard to calculate, right? Because we can look at the number of people who were fired from the federal government for disloyalty. But then there are a lot of people who are simply sanctioned, but were allowed to keep their job. People who found their careers not ended, but derailed. The number of people who never went into fields like teaching or federal service because they wanted to avoid this. There's the cost imposed by one's own conscience when you do collaborate. The actor Sterling Hayden, who people will remember from Dr. Strangelove and The Godfather, he testified. He collaborated with HUAC he thought he'd lose custody of his kids. And he would say for the rest of his life that he hated himself for what he did. And, he had a great career, but he himself felt broken. He's a consequence. He's a victim of the Red Scare. And so in some ways, it's incalculable how many people found their lives upended, found their lives ruined, found their consciences broken by this experience.
Gosh, just thinking about people like Helen Reed Bryan, who are brought into this committee to testify, Do you think we might see something like this today? You were on a recent show saying that you could envision that, let's say, five, quote, radical teachers could be brought to Capitol Hill.
Well, I'll be honest, I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
Wow.
I have no reason not to believe. And in fact, I mean, you look at certain figures in Congress who I imagine are chomping at the bit to do something like this and, you know, to make a show of students or teachers or, you know, pick your category to show some, to make some political point. And when that happens, and I am confident that it will, unfortunately, when that happens, those people are going to have to make a choice and they are going to have to decide, do I risk my career or do I collaborate? And simply by appearing is collaboration, because they're not just like with HUAC, they weren't looking for the truth. In most cases, HUAC already knew the names of people. HUAC already had the evidence. They already had the refugee committee's files. These were degradation ceremonies. These were ways of making everyday Americans feel afraid of their beliefs, of speaking out. It was a way of making them collaborate, not just with HUAC, but with the overall culture at the time. And I think there's every reason to believe that we're going to find ourselves in that place again.
And so the message then is very clear. You too might end up here. So watch what you say, watch what you do. How do you think the public should respond to this? Because people are preparing and they're wondering how to prepare.
I mean, I think one of the things that's important in any situation like this is to to prepare for being that person. I think we always, I don't know about you, but as a kid, even as an adult, you know, you go through these fantasy moments. Maybe you go visit the Anne Frank house and you think, would I be that person that turned her in? Or would I risk my life to keep her secret? And that's very dramatic, right? Most people never have to deal with that that consequence or that situation. But then suddenly we're getting close to situations where that might be the case, and you might find yourself in that place. So what do you do? And I mean, one thing I would just add to that is also the need for a certain amount of grace for people who do go along, because, and this is not the big law firms, I'm not talking about them, I'm talking about individual people, and talk about the example of Sterling Hayden. I mean, he had every reason to believe he would lose custody of his children if he didn't go along. And that's an impossible situation to be in. And I don't condemn him for making the choice he did, even though he condemned himself. And so I think it's just, I worry a lot that we are very quickly getting into a moral minefield that we as a country have not had to deal with, if not forever, certainly in a long time. And I just don't think the public is ready for that.
Mm. Well, it's also important to remember that university presidents had to testify during the uprising on college campuses to end the assault on Gaza. And then recently, the head of NPR, Catherine Marr, and the head of PBS were called to testify at a hearing called the, quote, anti-American airwaves, holding the heads of NPR and PBS accountable. This is chaired by Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who in the beginning of her speech used the word communist. Mm-hmm. And throughout the day, that word was thrown around many times.
Yeah, well, I think obviously we're getting into details a little bit with who should testify. I think someone like Catherine Marr had an obligation to testify because of her organizational, position. But I think she also did a great job in that position. And I think, look, that's also a calculation you make, you know, not simply saying yes or no, but saying if I go and testify before what is obviously a bad faith committee, can I come away having done something good? Right. So Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the Hollywood Ten, he appeared, early on in the Red Scare. And not only did he stand up to HUAC, but he made it very clear what the stakes were. And his statements, while they were gaveled down and he was essentially shut up, they were covered widely. And he helped to galvanize, in some cases, people against HUAC and to show what the terms of this coming Red Scare were. So, there is value in that. And I think you just anyone who's in that situation has to think very clear-eyed about what they're getting into.
There's a great movie about Dalton Trumbo called Trumbo. It was made in
Yes.
2015. Everyone should see this. And you have really interesting information about Dalton Trumbo in your new book, Red Scare. In our remaining minutes, Clay, can you remind us how journalists and the media covered the witch hunt and the Red Scare? I mean, obviously, such a different media environment back then. When you think about the power that Edward R. Murrow had back then, and what he and his team did to educate people about McCarthy and the Red Scare.
Yeah, it's a great question. And in some ways, there is something of a parallel between then and today, because back then you had a dominant media, news media, which was newspapers, and you had an emergent media in television. And one of the things that I think McCarthy in particular did to extend his reign of terror was he understood how to manipulate the newspaper media and how deadlines worked. How fact-checking did or didn't work, how the ambitions of individual reporters worked. So he would call people up 10 minutes before deadline and say, "I've got an amazing scoop. Tomorrow I'm going to reveal the greatest spy scandal in history." And a reporter would have to say, "I don't have time to check that. Do I just print it? He's a senator, or do I risk someone else getting the scoop?" More often than not, they would print it, and it would be complete garbage. Murrow understood the power of television as being something fundamentally different. He understood that McCarthy got a certain amount of whitewash because of the way the newspapers worked, but that television could reveal him in all his sweaty, bullying ways by simply showing him speaking. And Murrow did that in an incredibly effective way. He bided his time. He built up his case. And in 1954, he showed his documentary. So, I guess you'd call it that. And it eviscerated McCarthy. It helped take him down. And I think today there's something similar that we might see, which is that so much of the media, and I include myself in this and my colleagues, we operate according to a conventional standard operating procedure. This is the way things work. And I think one of the things that's been very effective with the MAGA movement and with President Trump is they get how things have changed and they get the new media. And so, what I think the next step might be is that someone will come along, a Murrow type, who gets how it works. And this won't necessarily be a journalist, it could be another politician, it could be an influencer, it could be someone who just goes viral, but they get it in a way that the rest of us don't. And I think that to me, if I had to make a prediction of how this plays out, that's one that I would be happily surprised, maybe not so surprised to see.
Well, it was so interesting to learn that Murrow put together an expose on McCarthy. He quietly opposed the Red Scare for years, and he and his producer, Fred Friendly, actually personally paid for an ad to promote their program that night.
Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
so
Yeah,
interesting.
and McCarthy and Murrow actually employed blacklisted writers on his show. They didn't get credit, but he helped keep them employed
Wow.
quietly. So he was a real force.
Well, it's such an important book, especially now, Clay. Clay Risen is an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times, and his new book is called Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Thank you so much for this book, Clay, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.